Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Professor Ani Sarkissian, an assistant professor of political science and a core faculty member of the Muslim Studies Program and the Center for European, Russian, and Eurasian Studies at the Michigan State University. In addition to having appeared as a guest on our show about a year ago, Dr. Sarkissian also has been busy writing on a variety of topics, including Islam and politics, democratization, and the regulation of religious groups under authoritarianism. The latter topic will manifest itself in a book that is scheduled to come out with Oxford University Press in a few months, tentatively entitled The Varieties of Religious Repression: Why Governments Restrict Religion. She is also involved in a Templeton-funded research project being run through USC's Pentecostal and Charismatic Research Initiative that is examining Catholic charismatic renewal in Africa. And Ani is also part of a 12-member team exploring the relationship between religious liberty and social flourishing at Georgetown's Religious Freedom Project that yours truly also happens to be a member of. We'll have links to all these wonderful and amazing things over at www.researchonreligion.org. So get on over there and get click happy. That is an order. Ani, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me back.
So how's the book coming along? I got to ask that first.
It's almost done. We're just working on some of the finishing touches, and it should be in print in January or February of 2015.
Well, we are looking forward to that, and we will link to that and promote it when it comes out, because I've had the opportunity to read it. I even gave it a book blurb, and it is a great read. So make sure that we sell lots of copies of that puppy.
Thank you.
Today, though, we want to understand some of the political and religious changes that have occurred and are still occurring in Turkey. Now, this is an interesting country for a number of reasons, including its deep historical role as the center of the last Islamic caliphate, its modernizing and secularizing history during the 20th century, and its straddling of two worlds, the European and the Islamic Middle East. And also, and perhaps not least, it has a role in shaping the future of the region, either through direct diplomacy or serving as a potential model for what a more liberalized and democratic Islamic nation may look like, or not. Pundits and scholars often point to Turkey as an example of how a Muslim nation can be democratic, so we should think critically about how functional the Turkish system is, what may be some of its strengths and its weaknesses, and whether it is truly exportable to other nations. So, Ani, are you ready to talk Turkey?
I sure am.
All right. We're primarily interested in the changes that have occurred over the past two decades or so in that country, namely with the rise of Islamic-flavored political parties and how civil society has responded to political liberalization. But in order to do that, I think we need to understand the historical context in which this is all taking place. And the obvious starting point is probably with the final collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the rise of Kemal Atatürk. Could you give us a basic history of Turkey, maybe over the past century or so?
Sure. But if you'll indulge me, I'd like to go back maybe a couple of centuries. But I promise to be brief about it. I just wanted to emphasize kind of what the importance of the Ottoman Empire and how big of an entity it was before it started to break apart and ultimately met its end. So if we look at, say, the Ottoman Empire in the late 18th century or so, it consisted of the Balkans, Anatolia, which is what pretty much modern-day Turkey consists of, and also most of the Arab world, so the Middle East and parts of North Africa as well. So we've got this really big area of land that was mostly Muslim in terms of its population, but also had some Christian areas in the Balkans and Eastern Europe, and significant Christian and Jewish minorities in the Asian parts of the empire, these groups were mostly self-governing. The empire wasn't a modern state in the way that we think about how modern states are organized, so it depended on its dealings with representatives of communities all around the different territories. But it had, you know, all of these minorities kind of spread out all over the place who, as I said, could govern themselves, but also had kind of a second-class status. So they didn't have the position of kind of citizens that we have in a modern state. By the end of the 18th century, the Ottoman Empire was starting to be called the sick man of Europe because it was weak militarily and in financial crisis. And it was also facing dissolution from various parts due to the rise of nationalism and nationalist ideas that were coming from Europe into various parts of the empire. So especially starting in the Balkans and in Eastern Europe, but also spreading into the Turkish area itself. So the Sultan, who was the leader of the empire, had to deal with all of these various battles and mini wars that were going on in different parts of the empire, losing territory, owing a lot of money to the European powers. So we have an empire that's starting to crumble, and a lot of dissatisfaction among Ottoman elites as well. So in response, there were several reform movements that different sultans instituted to try to deal with some of these problems. I think the most important is a series of reforms called the Tanzimat, which took place in the kind of mid to late 1800s that started the end of the empire. And this series of reforms instituted things like guarantees for life and property, equality of subjects, secularizing some laws. So this was an attempt to try to keep together what was left of the empire and appease some of these people who weren't happy.
Now, I want to break in here a minute and ask you a question, because you said something very interesting, that Turkey or the Ottoman Empire was considered the sick man of Europe, and mm-hmm. its territory, it extends into the Balkans and territory deeper into Europe than what we visualize Turkey of having nowadays. This must have really given it this sense that it lived in two worlds.
Definitely, and that's something I think that's carried over into modern Turkey, which we can talk about when we get there. But yes, so it was this, you know, and it had a lot of connections to Europe as well, because there were people who traded with Europe, who were educated in Europe, coming back and bringing back ideas. And the European powers themselves were also very interested in what was going on in the empire. They were interested in some of the lands that the empire controlled. They were interested in what was happening to their Christian compatriots in parts of the empire. So it was definitely considered to be part of Europe because it literally was part of Europe.
Yeah, and then a lot of these reforms, I would assume, are being inspired by things that are happening on the Western European part of the continent.
Yes, for sure. And that actually kind of helps to continue my story about the decline of the empire, because what happens is in 1908, we have something called the Committee of Union and Progress, what we know probably better as the Young Turk movement, which was a group of young Muslims who were educated in Europe and were being filled with these ideas about liberalism and constitutionalism from Europe, who staged a revolution against the Sultan and wanted to impose a constitution and an elected assembly. So they put in a constitution, but they didn't depose the Sultan. They just kind of tried to bring in these new ideas. And under the Young Turks, the Ottoman Empire entered World War I in 1914, but on the wrong side. So they entered, they were in alliance with Germany, and they entered on the side of the Central Powers and were forced to capitulate in 1918. And as a result of this, this is kind of the end of the empire. The European powers occupied the territory. The empire was kind of divided up among the British and the French. So it was kind of broken apart. And a couple of years later, we have the birth of the Turkish Republic.
Okay, now in terms of the Europeans occupying the the Ottoman Empire. We would think, well, that's just the present-day Turkey. But this extends down farther south into the Levant and the Arabian Peninsula, correct?
Exactly. And this is, we're seeing the implications of that to this day.
Yeah.
So the territories of Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, those lines were drawn at the end of World War I by the European powers, and they took different powers, took mandates over different territories.
So the rise of the Turkish Republic is often associated with this guy named Kemal Atatürk. Who is this guy, and what are his plans?
Okay. Mustafa Kemal, who was later given the name Atatürk, or Father of the Turks, was himself a young Turk. So he had been an early member of the Young Turks, but he wasn't one of the inner circle, because the inner circle actually fled Turkey after the war, and they were kind of disgraced with the loss in the war. But he was a military leader, and he became successful in kind of leading this independence movement and establishing the Republic of Turkey after the empire had fallen apart and Europe had moved in. So he established the republic in 1923, and he was elected the first president, and he was able to kind of consolidate power in the first few years and create a one-party state. And Atatürk had some very strong ideas about what this Turkish republic should look like. His ideas are referred to as Kemalism, and they were founded on a number of principles, including republicanism, secularism, nationalism, populism, statism, and revolutionism. But the most important of those were modernization and secularism. And so he was his kind of top priority was to bring Turkey into the modern age, to make it look like one of the Western European countries, to kind of get it industrialized. And tied to that, which reflects a lot of what was going on in Europe as well with ideas about modernization, was secularization. So taking kind of traditional religious institutions and traditional religious practices out of society and putting them kind of into the private realm.
Now, he's going down the secularism path, and one question that I've always wondered, and I'd love to transport myself back in time and be at the decision-making points, you know, this era of the 1920s, why doesn't Atatürk try to lay claim to a new caliphate? I mean, obviously, he's been influenced by secular ideology, but you know, is there also problems with territorial claims that, you know, he's just not going to be able to get Turkey to have the expansive empire that it once did?
That's part of the story, but another part of the story is also the fact that the caliph represented an alternate source of authority that could challenge Atatürk. So at the time that the Turkish Republic was established, there was actually still a caliph, and the caliph didn't have any formal political powers. He was just seen as a religious leader. But by many, kind of informally, he was seen as head of state. And that was threatening to a new leader like Atatürk, who's trying to establish his authority and his legitimacy as the head of the republic. And so he had the caliphate abolished in 1924 to consolidate his position as head of state and not be challenged by the caliph himself, but also these traditional religious institutions that had a lot of power in the Ottoman Empire, and that could potentially represent a challenge to him and this vision that he had for modern Turkey.
Okay, so what does he do to assert his authority over this? What is the republic looking like? You mentioned a number of isms, but how does this manifest itself in actual policies?
So creates a constitution. He institutes industrialization policies, but one of the things that is probably most closely associated with him was the secularization policies that he instituted. And these included things like shutting down popular religious shrines and Sufi brotherhoods orders that kind of expressed popular religiosity. He outlawed religious headgear, so the turban and the fez were no longer allowed to be worn in public, and people had to wear European-style hats with brims. He secularized family law. He had Islam as the state religion kind of removed from the Constitution. He secularized the educational system, adopted a Latin script, replacing the Arabic script that had been used before, made changes to the language to kind of Turkify it, and kind of created this new history of Turkey to separate it from its Ottoman origins. And then the other kind of big institutional change that he created was in 1924, he created the Directorate for Religious Affairs, or the Diyanet, which was attached to the Prime Minister's office and was the central organization that was to manage all religious affairs kind of going forward.
So what does that mean, manage religious affairs?
So Turkey has a really interesting idea about what secularism means. I think in the West we usually think about secularism as religion-state separation. And in Turkey it's interpreted in a way that basically amounts to state control over religion. So the Directorate for Religious Affairs owns and runs all of the mosques in the country. It appoints all of the clerics to the mosques, trains them in government schools, pays them, so they're actually civil servants, and even writes sermons, even tells them what to say during Friday sermons. And so it's a very, it's kind of an interesting way of thinking about separation of, or secularism, when it is such a tight state control over religion. And the other thing that's interesting about it is it only really thinks about Islam in Turkey as being the kind of Sunni, majority Sunni Islam that about 70% of the population follows, doesn't really recognize that there are other forms of Islam that are being practiced in the country, forms of Shiism, other schools of Sunni Islam, and so doesn't recognize their religious buildings or their leaders as part of this directorate, and kind of doesn't actually give them any religious legitimacy at all, considers all kind of Islam in Turkey to be the state-mandated Sunni Islam.
Now, one of the things that you do very well in your research is to examine civil society, which are all the private organizations, entities, and ways people live their daily lives in different communities. How did civil society take to all these reforms? Did the clerics just say, well, I guess we're state employees now, and just roll over, or was there some conflict, some turbulence?
There was both. A lot of the people who weren't very happy with how things were going were people who belonged to these religious brotherhoods that had been around for centuries, and so they were outlawed under Kemal, under Atatürk, so they went underground and kind of operated secretly, but still kept meeting and just kind of operated outside of the state structures, but weren't allowed to be open in what they were doing. And everyone else just kind of had to play along with the rules, because if they didn't, they faced severe consequences. Atatürk's regime was definitely an authoritarian one. Some people have called it totalitarian. But it, you know, there wasn't a lot of room for dissent during that period.
Okay. And now he lasts until about 1938. He dies 37, 38?
38,
yeah. 38, okay. And what happens afterwards? I mean, you get a lot of these authoritarian governments that are structured around a very powerful and charismatic figure. They pass from the scene and a lot of changes take place. What starts going on in the 1940s and 50s?
So in the 1940s and 50s, we start to see some opposition parties being formed. So under Atatürk, this Turkey was a one-party regime. And starting in 1950, the first opposition party wins elections. And we get a series of parties being formed and contesting elections. And we don't really get one leader again like Atatürk, even though there are other people who who do manage to hold on to rule for maybe 7 to 10 years or something like that. But we see a series of parties being formed, and also at the same time a series of military coups happening. And these occur for various reasons. Initially, we see the coups, the first coup, I guess, in 1960 happened when the Democrat Party, which was the first opposition party to win elections, started to kind of make a lot of changes, bring in some people from outside of the traditional, you know, the secular military elites that had been running the country, trying to do kind of a lot to bring the country forward, but also at the same time became increasingly authoritarian, and it was deposed by a military coup in 1960, and then we get, about 1960, and then we get, you know, several other parties being formed, and in the 1960s, we see the beginning of Islamist parties being formed in Turkey, and Islamist movements. And this is an interesting development because, according to the law and the constitution, parties are not allowed to be based on religion in Turkey. This is not, this is illegal in Turkey. But these Islamist movements are starting to get more popular, and especially in the 1970s, in the 60s and the 1970s. So the first Islamist party, the National Order Party, was formed by someone named Erbakan, and he becomes a very important figure in the Islamist movement throughout the 70s and the 80s. And this party gains some power. There's a lot going on in the world. As we know, in the kind of late 1970s, the Iranian Revolution happens. There's Marxist movements, socialist movements. So there's a lot of unrest in Turkey as well. There are big rallies, protest rallies. There's even some terrorism, some extremist movements. And so there was, again, a military coup in 1980 that kind of led to a period of suppression of these terrorists and leftists and some Islamists as well.
Let me stop you right there at 1980. That's a nice breaking point. A lot of people talk about the 79 Iranian Revolution, and also in Turkish history it seems to be another breaking point with the military coup. And let's step back a little bit. And you said something that was interesting, that during the 1960s some Islamist parties start to organize. Now, we hear that term today, and we are recording this on July 1st of 2014, and in the news there's this talk about this Islamist government that is sweeping through Syria and Iraq. There's the ISIL movement, and it's causing a lot of conflict. And so usually today when we hear the term Islamist, we tend to think very radical, revolutionary types of groups. Is that what these Islamist parties were back in the 1960s or 70s, or were they something different?
Not necessarily. I mean, there were some extremist groups at that time as well, but the more kind of mainstream Islamists that had kind of greater popularity were ones that were more akin to, say, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So these were parties that were supported by religious voters. They were conservative in their orientations in terms of their attitudes towards morals and social policy. And they did say, you know, they did, at least Erbakan himself, did support the use of Islamic law or the adoption of Islamic law, at least in terms of family law in the country. So similar to kind of these Muslim Brotherhood type movements that we see today is what we're seeing beginning in Turkey at that time.
Can I just ask one clarifying question? I hear this term come up a lot, and oftentimes I just nod and say, oh yeah, I know what that means because I'm a smart academic. But family law, what does family law include?
So family law includes things like issues having to do with marriage, divorce, inheritance, and these are things that the Quran and the Sharia, so Islamic law, actually has something to say about. When we think about Islamic law being the law of a country, there are lots of things that aren't covered, but family law actually is. So there are rules about say, for instance, whether a Muslim and a Christian can get married, or how divorce is conducted, or who can inherit what. And so a lot of Islamist parties will advocate for incorporating Islamic law, at least into the family law system of a country.
Okay, that makes sense. Family law deals with stuff that relates to families.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, somebody was thinking when they named that one. Okay, so we're at the 1980s. 1980 military coup, you say this leads to a period of suppression. What is this looking like, and what else happens then over the next 20 years or so?
I mean, another kind of interesting thing that's happening at this period, kind of in the 70s, 80s, that I haven't talked about is something called the Turkish Islamic Synthesis, which is actually quite interesting because it was something that was advocated by the military, which traditionally in Turkey has been a very secular and secularist institution and has been opposed to having Islam be a part of the Turkish Republic. But what the Turkish Islamic Synthesis was this idea that the military saw this kind of ideology of framing Turkish culture as being built upon Islam. And so it kind of fused nationalism, which was what the military was really good at, and Islamism to counteract the socialist and communist movements that were becoming popular at that time. So the military thought, okay, we want to keep these leftists out, and the Islamists are on board with some of the more right-wing policies that we like. So in order to kind of get them into our fold, we're going to encourage kind of a return to some of the Islamic roots of Turkish culture. And so what they did was they instituted things like religion and ethics courses that taught Sunni Islam. These courses taught that kind of patriotism and love for the state was a religious duty. They allowed new mosques to be built. They built new schools to train clergy. They also allowed more Islamic civil society to flourish, which kind of later had the unintended consequence of helping to reduce their powers substantially in the 2000s. But the military ended up, the military that had been so, you know, on the part of Ataturk and had been so anti-Islamist actually partly helped to bring about the resurgence of Islamist civil society in the 1980s.
And this is really interesting because it's something that we oftentimes overlook in the history of the region, and I definitely were overlooking it back then, was a lot of governments that were based upon Western socialist, Western democratic socialist principles, nationalism, things like that, really started getting a sense that there was some reawakening of Islamic civil society during the 60s or 70s. And a lot of these governments at that time start to adopt Islamic flavoring to their regimes. Is that correct in my reading of that?
Sure, yeah. So you see it happening in Egypt. You see it happening in other parts of the Arab, I believe in Syria as well. But for sure, so you see these governments kind of seeing, okay, well, we tried this very Western secular ideology. Doesn't seem to be that popular. We're not doing very well in terms of getting the countries modernized as quickly as we thought we were going to, and we need some support. And so they start to go back to some of these constituents that were already there to try to get some backing for their policies. And so they have to then make some concessions to the more religious parts of their populations that had never gone away.
So how does this help to reawaken Islamic civil society in Turkey, this Turkish Islamist synthesis? Are there some specific consequences that result?
I mean, one of, I think, the biggest consequences, which is tied to civil society, is the growth of the welfare party. And the welfare party couldn't exist without Islamist civil society. They're kind of a work together. But the welfare party was the kind of third or fourth incarnation of Erbakan's Islamist parties, because he kept starting parties and then they kept being outlawed by the constitutional court because they were Islamist parties. And so finally he started the Welfare Party. And the Welfare Party did something really smart in that it, in order to get support, it allied with and in many cases actually formed grassroots civil society organizations in urban areas. And Turkey has, one of the consequences of modernization and industrialization was you have a lot of people moving from the provinces who tend to be more traditional, maybe more religious, moving to the urban areas and creating these kinds of vast suburbs outside of the urban areas that are not necessarily slums in the sense of maybe some of the slums that we have in Latin America, but similar. Mm-hmm. And my co-author, Ilgu Osler, has done some interesting work on these kind of slums or squatter settlements. But the Welfare Party went into these areas, and they created these grassroots organizations that provided services to the people living in these areas. So bringing them water and bringing them sanitation and education and transportation. And that they kind of first created these organizations, and then they used these organizations to mobilize people politically to vote for them as a party. And this was very successful because they were able to start winning a good number of votes. Turkey has a 10% vote threshold to get into parliament, and so they were able to start winning elections and get their representatives into parliament. So they won, for instance, 17% of the vote in 1991. By 95, they got 21% of the vote and actually formed a coalition government with another party, and Erbakan became the prime minister of Turkey. In 1995. So an avowed Islamist became the prime minister based on this kind of grassroots religious civil society that they had helped to create.
So the military government, the coup dating back to 1980, and they have a close guardian watch over the country, they must have been decompressing or liberalizing the society over the late 80s or into the 90s. They just must have embrace this. I mean, my gosh, democracy is flourishing. Welfare Party, welcome aboard.
Not so much.
No.
So that coalition didn't last that long. In 1995 was when the election was. In February 1997, Turkey had what has been called a postmodern coup, which it basically was the army stepping in and saying, we recommend that you do these things to defuse fundamentalist threats to the country, but they didn't actually step in and overthrow the government. So they said, we think you should make these changes, or we suggest these changes. And so those changes included Erbakan stepping down as prime minister, and in 98, the Welfare Party was banned by the Constitutional Court, and Erbakan was banned from politics as well.
This is one of those great stories of unintended consequences. You form this Turkish-Islamist alliance, and actually you see this in other places in the Middle East as well, saying, oh, we'll be able to tame this force, and then all of a sudden it comes back to bite you. And in 1997, they're saying, going, oh, what did we do here? Let's try to redirect this river that's flowing into a different channel.
Yeah, but they actually created something that they couldn't really stop, because even though the Welfare Party was disbanded, the Islamists didn't give up. So they reorganized into two. Well, first they reorganized into the Virtue Party, which was also banned. But then they split up into two factions. And one faction remained kind of the old guard, Erbakan-type, more conservative Islamists that formed the Felicity Party.
Wait. Felicity Party?
Yes.
Well, I love that name. That sounds fun. Sounds like a fun party to be at.
Sadet, but it's translated as Felicity.
Okay.
And so that was one party, and that party still exists, although it's quite small. It doesn't have a large support base. But the other faction formed the Justice and Development Party, or the AKP, which is the party that's in government today. And this was formed by Erdogan, who's the current prime minister, and Abdullah Gül, who's the current president of Turkey. And they kind of used some of this organization that the Welfare Party had established, but they had a less overtly Islamist agenda. They did not call themselves an Islamist party. They made very clear that they were not an Islamist party. They called themselves a conservative democratic party, and they promised, they kind of ran on a platform of economic development, clean politics, no corruption, closer ties to Europe and eventual membership in the EU, and they were able to win elections in 2002 and an absolute majority in the parliament, which put Erdogan in the prime minister's seat, where he remains today.
Now, one of the things that the military in their 1997 coup, postmodern coup, we should say, and it sounds like comparative literature majors are taking over the government, but this postmodern coup gave courts the ability to decide whether or not a party is too religious or not. That seems pretty hard to determine. And I mean, how does one figure that out?
Well, it's not just religion that parties can be banned on. So parties that have ethnic parties, any sort of identity-based party can be banned by the courts. And so there have been 20-something parties that have been banned since this law was put into practice. And so it's, you know, there actually was a case brought up against the AKP to the court as well, trying to get them banned, but the court did not ban the party. And so there has to be kind of very clear indications that the party either is calling itself a religious or an ethnic party, or, you know, there's just kind of no doubt that it is. But the AKP from the beginning was very clear to and very careful to not call itself Islamist, or even Islamic, which is not as strong of a designation as Islamist. They really kind of kept that out of their platform. That's changed a little bit as they've gotten more and more power over the years, and so the party has been more of overtly more open about its kind of religious agenda as over the years. But at the beginning, it was very careful to distance itself from that.
One of the things that you do very well with your co-author, Ilgu Özler, is to highlight some of the paradoxes of some of these changes. You can't have a overtly religious party, but there are some strange things that happen to civil society that result from this. Step back a little bit and give us some idea of what is going on within civil society during the 1990s. Is there a continuation of this Islamic awakening? I mean, the government's controlling all these mosques. I don't know. I mean, that seems like they would have a great deal of control over this.
Yeah, so the government still has control over the mosques, but there are some changes that happen in terms of laws governing civil society, kind of starting in the mid-1990s, partly as Turkey is kind of looking west to think about joining the EU. So it entered a customs union with the EU in 1995, and so there are all these conditions that it was going to have to meet in order to join the EU. And part of this, one of these conditions, involved changes to laws about associations. And so what happened was in the mid-1990s, we have some relaxation of laws about forming associations. And so it becomes easier for people to become associations or to form associations at this time. And we see more and more groups forming kind of these formal associations. At the same time that it is easier to form an association, you still are not allowed to form an association or to discriminate as an association based on religion, ethnicity, or race. So in terms of religion, it means you can't have an explicitly religiously based civil society association. So if you're a religious group who wants to form an association outside of the official state apparatus outside of the purview of the Directorate for Religious Affairs, you have to form an association under another guise. So you have to call yourself a human rights association or an economic association or a charity organization, but you can't call yourself the Islamic Human Rights Association. You have to call yourself something else. And then, but basically, you can go ahead and cater to your Islamic constituents. You just can't be overt about it. So you do get, during this time and into the 2000s, a proliferation of new associations because of the relaxation of some of these laws.
It sounds like a lot of shell game playing that is going on here, where you just, you know, you're forming something with a specific intent, but you have to cloak it in some kind of strange rhetoric to make it pass muster in the courts.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that Ilgu and I found to be really interesting when we were doing our field work in Turkey. We spoke to a lot of civil society groups, both Islamist and secular, and there was a lot of this kind of hemming and hawing and suspicion of us, and we could tell that especially the Islamist groups were, you know, weren't sure where we were coming from, but were very clear to kind of distance themselves from any clear Islamist orientation or any clear connection to the AKP.
Now, this seems almost strange for me because you do create the situation where where civil associations have to cloak their true intentions. And if I was, you know, leader of the military and supposed to be guarding against these influences, I would want people to openly declare what they are. It just makes it easier to see. It seems that these groups are being forced underground, and that is, in many ways, undermining some of the intent of the reforms.
It is, and it's also, I think, what we argue is that it's undermining democratic consolidation in Turkey, because in order to have real advances in democracy, you need these groups that are independent of government, helping to organize people, to organize their interests, relay them to government, keep parties honest, bring these things into the public. But because of these restrictions on expression and on organization, they're not allowed to. So you don't have a civil society in Turkey, we would argue even to this day, that's able to kind of act as a check on government, which is one of the functions of civil society in a democratic society.
Yeah, you make the argument they tend to be captured by the political parties, namely the AKP. And you also make another statement, too. While the number of civil society entities increased, their impact in public life was relatively trivial. That's interesting. Explain that.
Right. So as you know, you have more and more of these organizations forming, but many of them actually aren't only form after the party has formed. And so what they appear to be is ways for the party to kind of channel either resources or open up areas of channels of communication to its base through these groups. So they're not, they don't really appear to be these autonomous independent associations, but rather look to be kind of clients of these strong parties, not just the AKP. We saw this on the secularist side as well, where you have civil society groups basically allying themselves with one or another party, because that's the only way that they're going to get their voices heard. And they're only going to get it heard by the party that they ally themselves with. Because the civil society sector is so weak in relation to parties in the country, they don't really have any sort of significant impact on politics in the country.
And what you point out to with Ilgu Özler is just absolutely fascinating. I love the two papers that you wrote on this, and we'll link back to some of these writings that you've done, because it really indicates in this process of democratization, liberalization, there's this interesting dance that always doesn't seem what it exactly is. Yes, we want to open up civil society, but parties don't want to relinquish control, and the civil groups really do want to have more autonomy, but, you know, they get stuff from the parties as well. So there's this strange symbiosis to all this.
Yeah, and I think that's really playing out, and it's been playing out in public more recently in the news with what's been going on between the AKP and the Fethullah Gulen movement.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really a good illustration of that. And that wasn't going on. I mean, the Gulen movement was very active when we were writing these papers, but this has gotten even more interesting lately.
Explain.
When we were speaking to these organizations and when the AKP was founded, there seemed to be a lot of links between the Gulen movement and the AKP. The Gulen movement is this very popular movement, religious movement in Turkey, led by a religious scholar named Fethullah Gulen, who is in exile in Pennsylvania now. But he kind of heads this very vast network of Islamic groups that run mostly educational and kind of charity organizations, but they also have, they own newspapers, different media outlets, and things like that in Turkey. They've gotten really big, and they are present kind of worldwide today.
So why did this guy choose to exile himself in Pennsylvania? I mean, if it's pretty big, all the places you go, I'd like go to, you know, San Luis Obispo in California, someplace sunny or something.
I'm not quite sure why he picked Pennsylvania.
Okay.
But he was kind of forced out. There was a danger that he was going to be prosecuted for fomenting religious hatred or something like that. I mean, for kind of being threatening secularism in Turkey. And so he left before he could, he's in self-exile. But the Gulen movement, at the time that we were doing these interviews and at the time of the AKP's founding, was very important to the rise of the AKP and to the support that the party had. So these two were close. The Gulen movement itself is somewhat secretive in its operations, and so they're not very forthcoming about their political activities, and they won't actually admit to being politically involved. They say they're purely interested in kind of the social aspects of Islam, not the political ones.
Mm-hmm.
But many of the members, the leaders of the AKP, were members of this movement or affiliated with it, and so there were a lot of connections between the two. But in recent years, as we've read in the news, there's been a break, a split between Erdogan and the Gulen movement. The movement had succeeded in getting a lot of its members into kind of high-ranking bureaucratic positions in the country, and it's unclear why this break happened. One of the stories that I've heard has to do with differences in terms of attitudes towards Islamism in general. So Gulen is more concerned with interreligious dialogue, wants to maintain friendly relations with Israel, wants to kind of keep this very open liberal notion of Islam, whereas Erdogan has seemed to go in a more towards a more Muslim Brotherhood, look towards Arab countries direction, and has had problems with Israel in the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the stories is that there were some issues over that, but it's not really clear what the split was. But because these Gulen people had become had these positions, especially in the judiciary, they were able to bring these corruption charges against Erdogan and try to prosecute him that way. And he ended up purging a lot of them. And now there is a complete break between the Gulenists and the AKP.
Yeah, I can imagine if you start prosecuting the guys that kind of brought you into power, they're going to kick you out too. So this is this is becoming an ugly in-family fight, I guess.
And there are rumors of the Gulenists perhaps forming their own party, and it's not clear if that's going to happen. But there have been some rumors about that, and I think partly because they know that as a pure civil society organization, they're never going to have enough political power to kind of change policy. They need to be in politics formally in order to have an effect on policy.
Now, several months ago, there was some riots in the street, fairly substantial ones, involving some closure of a park or something like that. Is this a manifestation of the tensions that are occurring here between these two groups?
Somewhat, but there are other tensions as well. So there, even though the AKP has been quite a popular party and has managed to win votes not just from the religious segments of society, but from others as well, so others who are kind of fed up with corruption in the country or who are fed up with the pace of economic development, these people started to get disillusioned as Erdogan seemed to be turning slightly more authoritarian over the years. And so there were lots of different groups of people who came out to protest. So young people, there were religious people as well. So you did see a lot of, you know, women in headscarves and things at these protests as well. But kind of going back to the argument that Ilgun and I have, one of the reasons why these protests never really led anywhere was there were no strong civil society groups that could organize together and form a kind of unified front. So it was a lot of these dispersed groups who were kind of showing up but could never get their act together to challenge the government.
You mentioned headscarves there a minute ago, and this brings up an issue of some of the demands made by civil society. And I know there's been efforts to continue to open up civil society. I'm sure there's people within Turkey who would like to have more freedom to form their organizations. What are some of the issues that are driving some of these folks? Is the headscarf issue still a big issue? Are there other things that matter?
The headscarf issue it's been mostly resolved at this point, but when we were doing our interviews, it was still quite a significant issue and one on which every Islamist group that we talked to put as their number one issue, even if they had nothing to do with headscarves or women's issues, even if they were an economic business association or whatever, they just thought the headscarf issue was the number one issue. This stems from a law that outlawed wearing headscarves in public institutions, including universities. And this ban had been enforced for a long time, and then successive governments had tried to kind of lessen the ban, and those had been overturned, and one of the things that the AKP had tried to do from the beginning was to overturn this ban. And finally, just last year or 2 years ago, they succeeded. And so now women can wear the headscarf in universities. So that's actually a victory on the part of, with the help of religious civil society, kind of working with the AKP to get this ban overturned. Another issue has been education. So there are these schools that train, that are kind of religious training schools. They're supposed to train clerics, and they're very popular in Turkey among certain elements of the population. But oftentimes they have more graduates than can actually become clerics. They can get assigned to mosques. And so for a long time there were differential tests, score requirements to get into universities. So it's hard for graduates of these schools to get into university. And if you don't go to university, you can't get a job in the bureaucracy or in the government. But religious civil society helped to kind of get some of these restrictions relaxed so that these people who graduated from these religious schools could then go to university and then get jobs in the bureaucracy. So you see more people now who have this kind of religious background and training working within the state apparatus.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
There have been other issues. Erdogan, a few years ago, there were some laws passed about restricting alcohol consumption in public. He's tried to get laws about adultery passed. So there have been other efforts to impose some more kind of laws based on Islamic morals. And these have kind of satisfied the religious base but inflamed the secularist kind of opposition.
One of the other things that has cropped up is that there's this downplay of not only religious issues but also or religious identities but ethnic identities. And Turkey has this big thing going with the Kurds. Has there been any movement on that front?
There has, and actually one of the successes, I think, of the AKP has been to improve relations with the Kurds. The attitude of the AKP towards the Kurds has been kind of a religiously driven one. So, you know, the Kurds are not, they are our Muslim brothers. So emphasizing, rather than emphasizing the separate ethnic identity of the Kurds, they've tried to emphasize the common Sunni Islamic identity of them. And in that way, we're able to get votes from the Kurdish areas and to get cooperation from the Kurds. They also very rightly changed some laws to give more recognition to Kurdish language rights. So there have been some good improvements in terms of the situation of the Kurds since the AKP came to power, partly because of these ideas, these kind of Islamic or inspired ideas.
And that brings me to something that I mentioned in the outset of the interview, which is the role that Turkey plays more regionally, both as a direct influence, but also its role modeling of what a society in the area can look like. And as we know, just by looking at the front page of the New York Times or Wall Street Journal, things are very fluid there right now. And the issue of the Kurds, I can imagine, is of high priority to the government right now, because you have Kurds reasserting themselves in Iraq and, talk of Kurdistan, and my gosh, that might have some territorial implications for Turkey. Just a more broadly general question here to finish up with, and that is, what is Turkey's role in the future in the region? Is it a bright player in the region, or is it a non-player?
So, it is a fluid situation. I think there are some important things to kind of look for going forward. The AKP has recently come out and saying that it would not oppose an independent Kurdistan, which is a very big shift in kind of Kurdish, in the Turkish position, which has always been opposed to an independent Kurdistan. And so perhaps independent Kurdistan is better than warring Iraq at this point for Turkey. It's not clear. Erdogan was trying to position himself as kind of a leader of the Islamic world, but has had some problems doing that. He has not seemed to ally himself on the right sides or the sides that have actually won. And the rest of the Arab world doesn't seem to really want to accept him as the leader of the Islamic world. So it's not really clear if he's going to be successful in that. In terms of Turkey being a model of Islamic democracy, I think that's a very compelling and appealing notion. But just today, earlier today, Erdogan announced his candidacy for the Turkish presidency, and the elections happen next month, which means that he will be in power for another 5 years, because he's probably going to win the election. And so we're kind of seeing something similar to a Vladimir Putin thing going on in Turkey, and so that I don't know how that's going to bode for kind of Turkish democracy going forward if Erdogan wins the presidency and makes it into a stronger institution, which is what he said he aims to do. And so whether Turkey is going to be a model for the rest of the region is still to be seen.
And just to finish up here, you do a lot of work with civil society and civic organizations. Do you see a flourishing of Turkish civil society in the near future, in the next 5 or 10 years, or are you optimistic about things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there, that civil society exists in Turkey, and it is flourishing, and people really are involved. They're politically aware, and they're politically involved. There are still impediments in terms of how strong the parties are, and I think there still needs to be further relaxation of laws to allow these groups to kind of be honest about who they are and express themselves without limitations. And so I think if that can happen, we might be able to see a stronger role for civil society. I mean, it's obvious from what's happened in the past couple of years that people in Turkey are very politically involved. I mean, they're willing to turn out for protests. You know, they're willing to get involved in these groups. So I think there's definitely a lot of optimism there. But there still needs to be some of the power of these parties and now this individual ruler, some of that needs to be broken down in order to get a real kind of pluralistic kind of conversation going on in the country.
Well, it is a constant struggle, not only in Turkey, but throughout the world. And it is something we will be watching out for. My guest today has been Ani Sarkissian. Ani, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.